Hello out there.
Yes, hello everyone, and welcome to None But the Brave, a part of Evergreen Podcast. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy Flynn McLean, and this is the season premiere of our third season. Hard to believe. What do you think?
That's true. Whoever thought that 2 years ago we'd still be talking about this guy like we do.
Well, I just can't believe people are still listening.
Oh, there is that as well. That's actually the bigger mystery.
They're listening, I think, because we have been very fortunate to get some really great guests on the show. The last season ended with the guys from Backstreets. And tonight we have a really, really big guest, and we're very excited about it.
Oh, very excited. This is our first East Reader.
Yes, and maybe we'll get the big guy too. We'll see.
If dreams came true, wouldn't that be nice?
Yes. So I think let's get right to it tonight. What do you think?
Let's stop delaying and get to it.
All right. So tonight we have a guest who absolutely needs no introduction to our audience, but what the hell, Flynn will introduce him anyway.
Our guest tonight has been the consigliere to two of the most famous bosses to come out of New Jersey. He's a musician. He's a singer, songwriter, arranger, producer, actor, TV writer, TV producer, educator with teachrock.org. And now he's an author with his newly released autobiography, Unrequited Infatuations. Stephen Van Zandt, welcome to the podcast.
How we doing, boys?
We're doing really well that you're here. Thank you so much.
Very excited.
Hey.
All right. So we have read your book, and it really is an excellent memoir of sex, drugs, rock and roll. I mean, you have lived an amazing life, and it comes across in your book. I mean, I hear your voice as I'm reading. Was that the intention?
Yeah, that's always the first sort of challenge. And I decided, you know, the way to do it was to picture doing the audiobook, you know, which I knew I would eventually be doing, and kind of write it that way, you know. So I told the editor and the publisher, I said, look, this is going to not be grammatically correct. Okay, you're going to see a lot of weird sort of fragmented sentences, etc. But I said, you know, I'm doing that intentionally, and I wanted to read the way I talk, you know. So they went along with that, luckily for me. Right. And that's why, you know, it does sound like me because it's me. You
know? Really, some of these books, you wonder, is the person going to go there, especially in these rock and roll autobiographies? And your book, I tremendously enjoyed it. I know Flynn tremendously enjoyed it. You really don't hold back. Did you feel at any point like, ooh, if I say something like this, someone's going to be upset? Obviously, you've worked with some really big people.
Well, I left out most of those things.
Really? Wow.
You're getting the things that, you know, I thought were, you know, relatively civilized. Look, it's the truth. I try to be mostly, positive. I left out a lot of the negative stuff. You know, you run into a lot of assholes in 40 years, you know.
Especially in your business.
And without having a manager, there's no buffer, you know what I mean? So you're literally, you know, constantly, having contact with less than savory people. And, and I don't cause trouble for anybody. You know what I mean? I don't look for trouble. I don't start trouble ever. But there are people who want to start trouble with you, you know, just the way in human nature is for some people, whether, you know, for whatever reason, you know, they want to fuck with you. And, so occasionally you gotta deal with it, you know. And I literally, there's less than half a dozen examples of it, I think, in the book. And believe me, that's out of, you know, 50 or 60 that there could have been. So, you know, and I left out some of the worst ones, you know. I wanted it, I had I had bigger things on my mind than, you know, that kind of, you know, that kind of gossipy type stuff. You know, I didn't want to do much of it. And my own narrative is the least interesting part of the book for me. You know, I wanted to share what I've learned, share a little bit of the multiple crafts that I've been involved in, and you know what I mean, and kind of pass along what I've seen, what I've done. So it's not about me so much as where I've been and what I've done and what I've seen, and you know, hoping that it would leave behind something that's more useful. I didn't want it to be just about a rock and roll guy, or limited to a rock and roll audience, or even a music audience. You know, I wanted it to read like a detective novel, you know, where you don't know what's coming next, because I didn't know what was coming next. You know what I mean? It starts off as a music book, obviously, because that's where I start, you know, but then it kind of just goes into these other places reflect the more universal quest for one's identity, you know, and one's purpose in life. You know, I think that's something that everybody goes through, and I wanted to pass that along, you know.
Let's go back to the beginning, because in the book you write so passionately about the artists that had an impact on you, especially the Beatles. And then by the end of the book, you brought it full circle. 50 years later, Paul McCartney wants to play with your band on your stage. What do you think your 15-year-old self would have thought if he could hear that story?
There's no chance that he would have had that kind of imagination. The whole thing was a fantasy. I mean, the Beatles' existence was a fantasy. You know, for those of us who really were not fitting in to the society we were presented with, you know. And keep in mind, all right, before the Beatles, there was no sort of teenage industry, you know? I mean, teenagers themselves were only 10 years old. You know, teenagers were invented in the 50s, as I talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. That whole, I set up the Beatles entrance by talking about how the whole thing really started in the 50s with leisure time after World War II and all that, you know, and how all of a sudden we were the richest country in the world. And, you know, that awkward couple of years between adolescence and adulthood suddenly became 3, 4, 5 years and became this thing called the teenager. Didn't exist before the 50s. And so suddenly there was this huge teenage marketplace, you know, for which people, of course, and you came up with all kinds of things to supply them, because we are the kings of capitalism, after all.
Yes.
So we come up with, you know, hula hoops and yo-yos and you know,
all those fun fads,
including this thing called rock and roll, you know. But it was kind of a novelty acts and kind of these bizarre pioneers, you know. They were all weird and weirdly entertaining and weirdly novelty acts, really. And then suddenly all of the things we thought were novelty acts turn out to be the naissance of a renaissance. You know, suddenly they're the pioneers of a new art form. And so the entire 50s had to be looked at an entirely different way after the Beatles and the rest of the British invasion hit and credited them. You know, people we never heard of, you know, my generation.
Right.
I never heard of Chuck Berry, never heard of him, never heard of Bo Diddley, never heard of Little Richard, I never heard of Muddy Waters. Why would I? How would I know them? You know? So boom, you know, and suddenly, so not only are they turning us on to our own black roots of popular music and rock and roll, but they're suddenly they're a teenage industry, and so every band that has come after them owes them that gratitude, because there was no such thing. There was no such thing as bands, first of all.
Right.
Or you had solo artists all the time.
Yeah, solo acts and doo-wop, you know, doo-wop groups, you know. And so but they introduced the idea of young people actually being in business. You know, they were, you know, however, 19, 20, 21 years old, you know. This was a whole new weird thing, man, that was a miracle for those of us, again, who were not really you know, I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to work, you know, work a normal job. I didn't want to go in the military. I was too small for sports. What am I going to do? You know? And suddenly, boom, here's this new world. And boy, was that exciting. I mean, it was like literally a lifeline, you know? You know, you're drowning, you know, in this weird world. You know, you really can't figure out where your place is. And suddenly, you know, they threw that lifeline. And as I say, the Rolling Stones really completed it because the Beatles were just way too good to imagine doing it. I mean, by the time we saw them, they were halfway through the career and they were extremely sophisticated. I mean, you know, the harmony was perfect and the hair was perfect and they were perfect, you know. And the Stones came 4 months later and made it look easier than it was. So the way I put it is the Beatles revealed a new world and the Stones invited us in.
Okay, that's an interesting way to put it. Where does not to go back too much, but where does Elvis fit in the 50s?
Where Elvis Presley?
Yeah, where does he fit in your narrative there?
Well, extremely important. Arguably the most important guy in terms of the popularization of this new genre called rock and roll. In my mind, Little Richard invented it. Chuck Berry was indisputably the king of rock and roll for at least three reasons. He brought the lyrics, he brought the guitar, and the performance. His performances were extremely entertaining. So he made his lyrics not only were the greatest lyrics that everybody learned from and copied, but also he institutionalized this new thing called teenagers. You know, he actually put them in the songs, you know, this sweet little 16 and, you know,
Little Queenie,
drop a dime in a jukebox, you know, he's talking about, you know, that lifestyle that, you know, was fringy, you know, at best, and kind of just starting, you know, very, very nascent, you know, and he was just institutionalizing it, man, you know, and the kids go after school and they go to the malt shop and they put the money in the jukebox and they start dancing and, you know, man, it sounded like fun, you know, so Chuck Berry, you know, was the most important, you'd have to say, you know, Little Richard being the archetype and the one who embodied the entire sensibility of rock and roll. This is his androgyny, his liberation, he opened his mouth and out came liberation. Okay. And that's what the essence of rock and roll is. Chuck Berry brought the details but they both had one problem. They were black, you see? So that was very limiting in those days. They had black radio and they had white radio, you know, and eventually now Alan Freed and a couple of other brave DJs would start playing that black music for white kids, which was not a good thing to do. And they eventually crucified Alan Freed for doing it. But it really started, it was the game changer because then they started to cross over and then suddenly Chuck Berry was having hits on the white radio as well. But Elvis Presley, who is coming from mostly that black music, but also his first single really defines what rock and roll would be. You know, one side is black blues and the other side is hillbilly country, you know.
The guitars.
And that combination of hillbilly, and blues, that white and black thing was really embodied in Elvis Presley. So he didn't have the first hit. The first hit was Bill Haley and the Comets, Rock Around the Clock, which was the very first number one rock and roll song because it was a theme song to the movie Black Boy Jungle. But Elvis really, Bill Haley was a little bit, you know, he looked like your country uncle from, you know, from Mississippi. But Elvis had that whole thing, the charisma and the good looking the same androgyny that Little Richard had, by the way, but you know, a little less obvious, but a little bit less makeup, you know. And so Elvis, you know that his appearance on Ed Sullivan, 1956, I guess it was, I forget now, 55, 56, you know, we really blew the doors open. And so he was the most important cat in terms of publicizing and popularizing this new genre of rock and roll.
And then the bands came in, and that just blew the door open for everybody.
Well, that's a whole nother chapter, because all of those pioneers, keep in mind, they were all gone by the end of the 50s, early 60s. You know, the rock history went into this. It's kind of known as a fallow period, you know, kind of an in-between period. The truth of the matter is, a lot of good records were coming out in that period, but in between the pioneers and the British invasion, there was, you know, those couple of years where, you know, historians refer to it as a sort of, you know, slow period, because all of the pioneers were gone at once. It was amazing. Elvis is in the army. Chuck Berry's in jail. Bo Diddley became a sheriff. Little Richard became a minister. Buddy Holly dies in a car plane crash. Eddie Cochran in a car crash. You know, literally, all of a sudden, you know, they're all gone. You know, and what people thought, that's the end of rock and roll. Honest to God, that was the end. Now, like I said, a couple of people still making great records, you know, the Beach Boys, you know, and then Four Seasons and Gary U.S. Bonds and Dion, you know, there were still, you know, girl groups, you know, Motown got started in those fallow years, supposedly. So, you know, there was a lot of action, but it wasn't sort of, didn't seem to be socially relevant anymore, you know, or you know, something like that. And until the Beatles, then they introduced this concept of being in a band. And that's when I start tuning in, and a lot of people like me, I wasn't interested in show business really, and you know, in the entertainment business, but being in a band was appealing. You know, that's something I wanted very much to. I could really relate to the friendship part of it. You know, the family part of it. That's what attracted me.
So let's pick up there, because after the British invasion, as you just said, teenagers started to take up playing music. They got into bands, and areas created music scenes. And one of those scenes, of course, was down on the Jersey Shore, where you found yourself and where several other people who went on to prominence found themselves. What was it like being there in the mid to late 60s as that scene was really going?
Well, we were the luckiest generation by far, you know, and I actually feel a little guilty about it, how lucky we were, because you know, I don't know why our generation just had all the fun. We had a number of places to play as teenagers. You know, we're still in high school. And I mean, you know, beach clubs and high school dances and VFW halls and Latin de Vu, you know, nightclubs built for teenagers. I mean, whoever heard of that before or since, you know? Yeah, it was just an incredible time. So, you know, I don't know if you'd call it a scene exactly, but it was it was just a normal part. It became a normal part of your social life. If you weren't playing that night, you went out to see a band. I mean, that was it, really. I mean, you know, other than going to see a movie occasionally, that's all you did. You know, you know, it became a normal thing to see bands, and you know there was about a dozen in our area. We all got to be friends, and that's how it all started. You know, we were just there at the right time. You know, really, it was the right time. I mean, before the Beatles, before the British invasion, if you went to your high school dance, there would be an instrumental band. You know, there was no such thing as people, you know, singing and playing and eventually writing their own songs. I mean, that was just a completely foreign thing, no pun intended. But anyway, so we were just lucky, lucky. We, you know, there were no, like I say, there was no bands in America, February 8th, 1964. The Beatles played a variety show called Ed Sullivan, February 9th, February 10th. Everybody had a band in their garage. Had a band in their garage on February 10th. And only about a dozen got out into the world a little bit. The rest mercifully stayed in their garage. But, we just weren't the lucky ones, you know.
So when did you first go to Asbury Park then?
The only time I visited Asbury Park was for a battle of the bands, which was at the Howard Johnson's, which is now where we're...
Tim McClune's
place, you know. I don't know how he rebuilt it, but there was to be like a roof. Used to be a rooftop where they had like a shell where bands played. And the only time I ever went to Asbury Park in those early days, until late '60s. And keep in mind, a lot happened in a short time in those days. Time was very, very different than now. You know, a lot would happen in months, you know, as opposed to now where 5 years goes by and nothing happens. You know, you would have an entirely new music trend coming at you at least every year, you know, and I go through it in the book, you know, year by year. But anyway, that was the only time I visited Asbury Park until Bruce mentioned this Upstage Club, which would have been, I'm not really great with these, with time.
68 or 60.
It all blends together, understandably.
68, 69, yeah, yeah. I think, right?
Because somewhere in there, you know. So that was the only, that was a bit of a trip, you know. It's about a half hour south, so it was not exactly your neighborhood. And then at that point, you know, right around then, Asbury, they ended up opening a Hullabaloo franchise, which, now that I think about it, is really years after the TV show. It's kind of interesting. That just occurred to me just right now, because the Hullabaloo show and Shindig, two of the great rock and roll TV shows we had on every week. You know, we must have had eight. I mean, believe it or not, like eight rock and roll TV shows on every week. You know, and people wonder why you get nostalgic. But Shindig and Hullabaloo, which I would have said lasted for years. If I was just being asked that, you know, in my mind, it seemed to last 5-6 years. Actually, they both were about a year and a half. So they were both gone by 66. And here we are playing this Hullabaloo Club, you know, later than that, like 2-4 years later than that. So that's kind of interesting. It just occurred to me. But the Hullabaloo franchise ended up creating a circuit officially. Hi, baby. My doggy.
Is that Edie?
That's Edie. You know, so there was a circuit, you know, there was a Hullabaloo in Freehold, there was a Hullabaloo in Asbury, and a Hullabaloo in Middletown, in my town. And that sort of created a triangle. And if you counted the beach clubs on the coast, it became like a bit of a parallelogram, you know, or square, you know. And that became the sort of our circuit, more or less. But at that point, Hullabaloo Club, you know, went right into the 70s, because we became the opening act for all of the bands coming through. You know, we opened for
sorry to interrupt, but who is we when you say we were the opening act?
So by then we ended up I guess at that point, you know, we had a different band every couple of months, and it probably was Dr. Zoom and the Sonic Boom, I think.
Band name ever.
So we were opening for, like, you know, Humble Pie and Black Sabbath and Jay Giles and Big Brother, you know. So, you know, but it's just interesting now that I think about it, because it's years after the show went off the air. So I don't know. Whatever.
You have some really interesting observations in the book around this time. You're in bands, Dr. Zoom and Sonic Boom. I believe Child was another one.
That was one of Bruce's.
That was just Bruce. Okay. Yeah. You were in Dr. Zoom and the Sonic Boom. But there's a point where you guys are together and you recount that you say to Bruce, you're going to be the leader, you're going to be the singer, and you're going to be the main writer. And you basically make him the front man.
Yeah, that was probably the very last thing we did, at least in my memory. So you Bruce fanatics out there, who know every single hour, you may have more knowledge about this than me. But I think that was the last thing we did. We tried a lot of different styles, a lot of different things, and then the very very last thing was kind of like a. What I just did the least previous 3 years, which was horns and girl singers, which was the final trend of the 60s. You know, the Southern soul meets rock meets blues meets gospel trend is the final yearly trend of the 60s. As I go through all of the trends, that's the one that. Really, it's hard to say where it started, but I attribute it to Delaney and Bonnie being the source of it, and extended all the way to Mad Dogs and Englishmen with Leon Russell and Joe Cocker, and that was the final evolution of the rock era, that particular Renaissance era. And that's the last thing we tried. We only did a couple gigs that I can remember.
This is Dr. Zoom or
no,
the Bruce Springsteen band. Bruce Springsteen band. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And you were actually doing a lot of, you did a bunch of shows in Richmond of all places.
Yeah.
And that seems to be where that chapter kind of ends. I mean, after that, it seems like Bruce, he said, you know what? I'm going to be a singer songwriter. I'm going the folksy route here.
Well, yeah, he didn't exactly say it, but he figured that out. He took a few months to think about it, and then just strategized that. But yes, it did end in Richmond because I remember our drummer Vinny Lopez punching our trumpet player in the mouth. He couldn't hit him in the shoulder or the stomach. You know, had to hit him in the mouth. And that was the end. And I stayed in Richmond at that point. And, you know, me and Johnny started Southside Johnny and the Kid, like a country blues duo. You know, that's kind of how I remember it. Because I remember being in Richmond when Bruce finally did call and say, you know, I got signed. We were down there. Me, him, Gary Talent was down there. Davey Sanchez was down there, and they'd drop in and be part of our thing, once in a while. And then once Bruce got signed, everybody came back up to see what that was all about.
And then you went to the studio for those sessions, and you didn't last very long there.
One session exactly. they were probably I'm guessing now, but I don't think they were thrilled that he was signed as a folk singer and suddenly he's got this band, you know, because it's really a pain in the ass economically, and nothing better for a manager or a record company than a folk singer, they're the cheapest thing you can have. One guy. That era it was still strong. That the singer songwriter era was still very strong at that point. And that was, the beginning of the fragmentation of the 70s. One of those fragments, very strong fragment, was a singer songwriter. And So, you know, they were hoping he would be, you know, the new whatever. And of course, the new Bob Dylan was the phrase. Right. But, you know, the new Jackson Browne, for that matter, the new Gordon Lightfoot, you know, the new, you know, James Taylor, the new Carole King or whatever, you know.
Anyway, right.
You know, and so he, I think he probably disappointed them very much by saying, oh, by the way, I'm really a rock and roll guy, you know. you know, so I, you know, so they, I did one or two takes on, for you, I had a bottleneck part, you know, I practiced, you know, and it was my, one of my first times in a studio ever. And you know, so I'm sure I was a little nervous, but, you know, they tolerated like two takes and they were like, no, thanks. You know, see ya.
I think your book is that's the first time that's been revealed, right? I don't think anyone ever knew you were in the studio for Greetings.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm not sure what's been revealed and what hasn't, you know, through the years. You know, I don't really follow the details.
But then after you left that studio, you left music.
Yeah, that was for me. I honestly felt like we'd missed the boat and it was over. You know, the Renaissance was over, and I was right about that. But, you know, I just felt, you know, we just missed the boat. So I just quit and worked for 2 years, worked construction for 2 years. And, you know, fate as fate would have it, you know, broke my finger playing football, still bent. And, to exercise my finger. I took a gig with a bar band playing piano. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know, I couldn't really play piano, but I could play chords, you know. And that band, as fate would have it, you know.
A lot of fate here.
Coming, oh, a lot of fate, believe me. You know, it makes you wonder. And that band ended up being turning into the backup band for the Dovells. And suddenly I was on that, what they call the oldie circuit, and completed my education really in the music world. You know, that was a big year for me in terms of my education, you know, meeting all of those pioneers and listening to them every night. And even though they were all in a terrible mood, you know, except Little Richard, who was always in a good mood. But most of them were just they hated being called oldies. They hated being on the oldie circuit. They hated the fact that the British invasion put them all out of work, you know. And it was ironic, you know, the British invasion put all their heroes out of work. And they were put out to pasture, you know, late 30s, early 40s. That's you know, early. You're done. You're done for life, man. You know, if you had four hits when the Beatles came, you played those four hits for the next 40 years, 30 years, you know? It was just a terrible injustice. You know, just, you know, nobody's fault. It just happened that way because the next generation, starting with the British invasion, the audience would grow right with them, which, you know, I talk about great detail in the book because that's one of the great accomplishments of the Beatles that goes unheralded is the fact that the Beatles invented and created the concept of evolution. There was no such thing as that, album to album. You know, if you look back at the 50s, look back at all of those 50s pioneers, all of them, and they're all terrific, and they all have very strong identities, which was essential. But if you listen to their work, all of their work is very similar. You know, you listen to, you know, Drifter's album, you know, they're all obviously Drifter's songs in the way that you picture that, you know. Or Chuck Berry, you know, Chuck Berry's great 28, you know, same three chords, you know, same you know, I mean, just very, very, very similar, which was that was the gig at the time, you know. Make sure your next hit is similar to your last one, so you don't lose your audience. You know?
It was all uniform.
Yeah, very, very consistent. If you go back and listen, get any greatest hits records from the 50s, and you'll find every song is extremely similar, you know. Not so with the Beatles, you know, who go from Twist and Shout to I Am the Walrus in 4 years, you know. I mean, play those two songs back to back, you know? I mean, and so that was, you know, that was just something that they introduced. So every audience from the Beatles on would grow with the band, you know? So to this day, here we are, what is it, 50, whatever years later, Who's the biggest acts? Paul McCartney, the Beatles, and the Rolling Stones, you know, right?
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, the Drifters and Coasters whoever are playing cruise ships if they're lucky, you know, and you know, that Chitlin circuit, man, you know, it's just one of those things. Anyway, so I was on that oldies, you know, oldies trip for a year, and I was the only one enjoying it, but I really did enjoy it and learned a lot. Yeah.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX, and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map, from Fall Out Boy to Slayer. Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey, and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listener survey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
And then you wind up, Bruce is now at a crossroads. His first two records hadn't really done very well. He's in the studio recording the third record, which becomes Born to Run. It's not going very well, and you happen to be there. This is one of the seminal E Street stories. You tell it in the book. It's hilarious. He's working with a horn section that includes big names, David Sanborn, the Brecker Brothers, and they turn to you and Bruce is like, this is not working. What do you think? And you say,
this sucks, or, you know, this really blows or something, you know, it's fucked up, you know? I mean, it was sad for me. You know, you're fighting your whole life to, you know, get in that studio, man. It's so exciting, you know? And that was the worst time to record in history, was the 70s. And I talk about it in great detail in the book, how the engineers had temporarily taken over and padding everywhere so there's a separation, you know, so they can control each instrument, you know, and it just, you know, it sounded fucking terrible. Okay. I mean, just terrible, you know, it's, you know, as you would imagine, you know, like singing into fucking pillows, you know?
Right.
So I'm on the floor, you know, I'm like, oh man, you know, here's my friend, you know, he's trying to make a record here, you know, and, you know, doesn't anybody know that this sucks? You know what I mean? Like,
must have known because they were having trouble getting it.
Well, oh man, were they having trouble, you know, and I'm like, I was very, very naive about it and very, you know, very, very primitive in my understanding of it. But I expected you walk into a studio and you hear like you're walking into a club to see a band, you know, you want to hear like, you know, a band, an exciting, you know, an exciting bunch of noise, you know, and man, was it not that, you know, and so I was kind of just getting upset that these guys are fucking up my friend's record, you know, I tell you, you know, I'm like, man, you know, this cat's, you know, he's made it all the way here to the finish line, you know, and now, you know, you guys are fucking it up. You know, and I didn't understand that they were going to then, you know, they take all of the room sound and excitement out of the recording And then they put it all back in the mix. You know, that was...
What's the point?
Honest to God, that was the concept of the 70s, okay? Don't ask me, you know? And you know, and they ended up, you know, they ended up doing a pretty good job. You know, Born to Run, you know, it sounds good, you know, miraculously, you know? Yeah, that's not as good as the river, of course. You know, which we did the right way. You know, but it's, you know, it's good. They did a remarkable job of, you know, piecing that stuff together, one note at a time, and you know, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You know. So anyway, so yeah, he says, you know, what do you think? I said, no, this fucking sucks, man. You know, and, you know, he says, all right, we'll go in there and fix it. Well, you know, go in and fucking fix it or something like that. So I just went in and did what I did every day with the Jukes, you know, sang them the parts. And, you know, and believe me, they were happy to get out of there. they would have took riffs from the fucking janitor, believe me. You know, just get us out of here, man, you know.
and then from there, you joined the band. You say in the book, I mean, you basically describe the bottom line as like a test run for you. I always thought it was you, that was you joined the band, period. And you were there,
it wasn't a test run. I joined the band when there was only 7 gigs booked. That was it. You know, the career was like over. And so it wasn't so much a test run. In my mind, you know, I wouldn't say in my mind that I had fully committed to it. You know, if that's what you mean by a test run, yeah, you might have a point there. Because, you know, I had the Jukes going and, you know, they were not thrilled that I was leaving the Jukes. I just got them signed. You know, Steve Popovich signed them and Stevie was like not thrilled that I was leaving them. He's like, you're half the band, you know, at least. You know, and we were really, me and Johnny were like co-singers, you know, we wanted to be the White Sam and Dave, you know. And so finally get him signed with Popovich thinking I'm in the group. And then surprise, I'm leaving, you know. So they were not too thrilled about that. And, you know, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, really, you know. But so Bruce was just like, I'm putting the guitar down for these 7 shows. I've tried everything else. I'm going to try fronting. You know, maybe that'll make a difference, you know. Maybe that'll find a way to connect with an audience, you know. And it really did change the game quite significantly because, you know, frontman, you know, who's not playing an instrument, has far more contact and freedom and a much more intimate relationship, really, with an audience. You know, that guitar, you know, is great, you know, and of course the Beatles, you know, are the ultimate example of that, but it's a barrier. It's still a bit of a wall between you and the audience in a way, you know, in a sense, you know, unless you're Jimi Hendrix, you know, in which case, you know, the guitar becomes every woman in the audience. And you are making love to that woman, you know, that's string woman, you know, but, you know, he's a rare exception. I think for the most part, the performers, really, if you think of performers, they're always the front men, right? It's Mick Jagger, the most famous of them all. You know, it's Iggy Pop, you know, it's Peter Garrett, it's Johnny Rotten, you know, right? You know, Peter Wolf, you know, the great performers, you know, are always, you know, the ones trying to be Jackie Wilson and James Brown and, whatever. Sam Cooke, you know.
So after you join the band, now, of course, unfortunately, trouble sets in. There's a lawsuit that Bruce gets hit with. He can't record. And you tell a really, really in a compelling fashion in the book, there's a band meeting. People aren't getting paid at that point. And a vote is going to be taken to disband the E Street Band. And the first 3 guys vote, let's leave. And at that point, you in the book relate that you're like, hold on now, we can't do this. And Steve Popovich, who you just mentioned with Southside, plays a key role here. You actually basically save the day.
Saves the band.
Yeah. You know, who knows what would have happened, but it was a scary moment for sure. And things were not looking good. You know, they really weren't. You couldn't blame the guys for thinking about leaving, because it just was at that point a failed experiment. You know, it was kind of, you know, it was, you know, but I was like, man, you know, I don't know. I don't think I didn't lose faith in Bruce for you know, for one single minute. And I never had, you know, I was kind of the first one to have faith in him in the first place. And I saw something in him very, very early on that nobody else did.
Right. Well, and, as we mentioned, you were the one who said to him, you're going to be the front man.
Yeah. But even before that, I mean, he just was different, you know, he was different. And I liked that difference where most people, you know, are afraid of those who are different or putting it down or, you know, disturbed by it or confused by it. I liked the fact that he was different and was so single-minded, you know, whenever I had some doubts, you know, about my own single-mindedness having to do with rock and roll, you know, he was the only other guy I could rely on who felt rock and roll was everything, you know, not just, you know, this or just that, just a hobby. It was everything, you know? So, you know, we strengthened each other that way, I'm sure, right from the beginning. And, you know, so I didn't quite, you know, my tendency at that point was to blame other things, you know, I'm like, it's not my friend's fault, you know, that things aren't selling, you know, he's not a fucking promo man or marketing guy, you know, he's an artist. I mean, you know, anyway, so who knows what would have happened, but yeah, Steve Popovich saved the day that day. And then Frankie Barcelona really made it, you know, a huge difference. Who was one of my lifelong, another one of my lifelong friends who really had juice in those days. I mean, he was really the godfather of rock. And I wish I'd written the book about him that I tried. I so often wanted to do. And somebody will write it, or maybe I'll write it eventually. But somebody needs to write a book about Frank Barcelona, who was the most important guy, arguably, in the history of the rock industry. Certainly,
oh, wow.
Single-handedly created the entire rock era. You know. Anyway, well,
because of how he booked his tours.
Well, very briefly, I go a little bit more detail in the book, but he did a few things that no one had ever done. Number one, he felt that the most important thing for a band is live performance. He felt that the records and radio would catch up to that. That was a completely new idea. He structured the entire rock industry the way that Maranzano and then Luciano had organized the mob. Everybody got their territory, you know. He's new. He put his own promoters in place, you know, and the old mustache Pete's, as we call them, the old promoters who hated rock and roll, you know, and would steal left and right. He got rid of them and started putting his own promoters in place. And he said to them, because at that point, rock and roll literally was coming and going in the Wild West, and who knows, it was going to last another week, you know. He put his own people in place and said, listen, you're going to lose money on the first tour or two. You're going to break even on the next tour or two, and then you're going to make money for the rest of your life. So everybody relaxed, and Frank created the concept of longevity, which didn't exist. Okay, so you know, and a bunch of other things, but he had basically completely transformed the business into a business that was legitimate, fair, dependable, consistent, and had longevity by himself, you know. I had, when I was shopping around, I'm trying to stop managing the Jukes. I'm managing the Jukes, you know, and then I joined up with the E Street Band. I'm like, I got to get rid of this, you know. I don't want to be a manager, you know. So I'm looking around for managers. I'm looking around for agents. And I had run into him, and he became the Jukes agent. And boom, man, you know, we had no radio airplay. And we're making $1 million a year with the Jukes because of Frank's muscle. And so I was like, man, he's the best. My friend's got to be with the best.
Right.
So we ended up hooking that up. And then Frank loaned him a lot of money, which he needed, you know, just completely broke, you know. And it was like $100,000 at the time, which is like, you know, I don't know what, you know, million now, or, you know, half a million. So he really saved the day in two or three ways. I mean, financially, but also just bringing his muscle to the Bruce Springsteen, you know, in the E Street Band, meant that the promoters now, who had kind of given up on him, you know, they had to do what Frank said. And even the industry, even the record company and everybody else had to give him a second look now, because Frank just took over, you know, and nobody's going to fuck with Frank. Nobody, you know. So suddenly that Juice, I think, you know, helped out with the record company. It helped out with the promoters and gave us, you know, a little bit of wiggle room through the whole darkness period, which was still, you know, a bit chaotic, you know, until we finally could break through with the fifth album, with The River, you know. But it was Steve Popovich and Frank Barcelona that came to the rescue, you know.
Okay, so we're going to break it there. A bit of a cliffhanger, Steve telling the tale of 1977. As we all know, it turned out pretty well for them because they went on to record Darkness on the Edge of Town and The River. And we're going to address both of those records when we pick up with Steve in part two.
And you're not going to want to miss that.
And one last thing for tonight's episode, we also spoke to Steve about something very special he's doing with Backstreets Magazine.
You signed some baseball cards of yourself as Miami Steve for Backstreets.com to sell. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. I
you don't sound too thrilled.
We both bought it.
Yeah. I was coerced by the Jersey guy. Richie Russo had this idea, and you know, I don't mind really. It was a funny thing to do, and I thought, you know, is anybody really gonna, you know, respond to that? And he says, yeah, watch, you know.
Massive so, response.
Yeah.
It's been
kind Chris of just funny. Tweeted about it today.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm signing, I don't know, we'll see how many. However many sell, I'm gonna sign.
Okay.
You know, but not forever. You know, this is just a finite, you know.
Period. So if anyone wants the book, they can go to backstreets.com and get the Miami Steve signed edition. The yes. Little Steven signed edition is available through many bookstores. Check it out on the internet. There have been links through Steve's account and through some of the other accounts. Also, it's going to be available through all retailers, Amazon and your Barnes and Noble. And as we said when we started the show, it's a phenomenal read. We're not just saying that. It really is.
Very fun. Very fun. I mean, I laughed out loud and my wife would be like, what's so funny? And I would have to explain to her, you know, well, I don't want to. Steve, you had a little addiction in the 70s. I don't want to talk about it, but I'm not talking
we're
about
not
the
going, we're not going Steve. There. Let's go back to...
I'm sorry.
but just to finish the thought, you know, I tell people, you know, if they have local bookstores, you know, and they're fewer and fewer, unfortunately, please support them, you know, and you know, the bigger chains, you know, are very necessary and very important for those who don't have the local bookstores, you know. And believe me, most of the country at this point don't have the local bookstores. So that's where the, you know, the Barnes and Nobles or Amazons or whoever it is really do an important job. But if you do have a local bookstore, you know, you should support it. The Miamis, on the day it comes out, September 28th, is the end of the Miamis. So the Miamis in right now.
Well, Chris said today when he tweeted, you have 3,000 of them. They've already sold over 2,000, so they're running out. He was, yeah. That's what he said in his tweet, yeah.
Oh. That's pretty good, huh? Yeah. Not bad, not bad, not bad. Yeah, no, whatever they sell, I'm going to do. So,
When they announced that, I right away, I was like, oh my God, I got to have one of those.
I don't know, whatever.
So again, that was Steve Van Zandt talking about Unrequited Infatuations, available September 28th.
What a treat. Oh, my God. I can't believe our good fortune. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but wow, that was great. And part two, I think, is even better.
Oh, I agree. That's when we get more to we talk about the river. We talk about Born in the USA and his solo stuff. And of course, the reunion era, as we like to call it.
Yeah. And one of my favorite parts of that, no spoilers, but he addresses some stuff from Letter to You that is really quite touching and emotional, I think.
Yeah, it's very, very unique perspective coming from Steve, that's for sure.
So you're not going to want to miss part two. That concludes tonight's episode. None But the Brave is a presentation of Bull Market Entertainment and a part of Evergreen Podcast. You can find us on the web at nonebutthebravepodcast.com. On Twitter, we're at NBTB Podcast.
So for Hal Schwartz, I'm Flynn McClain, again, thanking Steve Van Zandt for joining us. Such a thrill, and look forward to episode two of our interview with him, and we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.